Okay, yeah, and I love your story of making a lot of money and losing it. I just had my 35th birthday, so we'll talk about that. The pain side is what I love about podcasting because, look, a lot of the guys listen to this, they can't even imagine building a $1 million business in their whole life. Right. And so when they hear interviews with people like you, they're part of them just doesn't believe it, and they just all the self-limiting beliefs. And our audience is a lot of little itty-bitty artisan companies, you know. So I think that'll be awesome for them to know that you messed up, and whatever happened there, that would be awesome if we can talk about that.
Okay,
and we'll just play it by ear. Cool.
Yeah, I think it's perfect, Josh.
Okay, now can I do my cheesy podcast intro now? Okay, here I go. Hey, everybody, Josh here with the Quick Talk Podcast. Today is not a normal day, my friends. It's not normal. You're not going to listen to me ramble on about systems or automation or something that needs to be fixed inside your business. Today, I have a guest, and not a normal guest, a pretty high-level guest, really probably the most high-level golden child business guru I've had on the show yet. I respect him a lot. He's a very wicked smart guy, and he's a lot of fun. And you may have heard of him. His name is Mike McKenowitz. And his name's Mike McKenowitz. He's a prolific author, a small business nerd, just like me. And nerd. I'm excited to welcome you. Mike, how are you?
Good. I was thinking of that movie Revenge of the Nerds when you said he's a nerd. Nerds! Ogre, whatever his name is like, nerds, and the nerds look around and go, where's the nerds?
Yeah, they don't have good self-awareness, I guess, but no. Nerds make the whole world go round, you know.
Hell yeah,
they're the ones laughing now because all the other people work for them, right?
There was a anecdote about Bill Gates, and it starts off with Michael Jordan. It says, you know, Michael Jordan's won, I don't know what it is, like say 10 national championships, best highest shooting percentage of all time, heralded college athlete, and it just keeps on rambling on. And then it says Michael Jordan is worth, I think it was like $100 million. And then the next line says Bill Gates is worth $10 billion. And then it says nerds rule.
Yep. Well, all the technology, all the infrastructure, even the most basic of industries are all built by software people with borderline Asperger's in a basement. And they're super amazingly talented. And they don't get the love and credit they deserve. I consider myself a nerd in training because I can kind of speak with developers now and like almost sound cool until I mess up and then they kind of roll their eyes. But you don't have a software business though, right? I mean, you have coaching and all these. Can you break down what you're doing now and then we can dive into some of your history?
Yeah. So ironically, my first job, I was a programmer right out of college for a year. And I think that knowledge, that experience has been very important in my life in building structure. I think anything can be quote unquote programmed. So today I have my full-time business. It's called Profit First Professionals. It's a membership organization for accountants and bookkeepers in educating them, but also giving them this concept, a book I wrote called Profit First, basically licensing it to them. But that programming knowledge has been very important. And the lesson I learned is, you know, things have to be repeatable. If they're not, if everything is a custom job, if every member of my organization went through their own unique experience and I had to be changing for each one, I couldn't grow past, you know, 20, 30 members. It's too many moving parts. So, you know, from programming, I learned is just make it very consistent, make it very reliable. And that isn't a turn off to customers. When there's predictability, when they know they're going to get an end result, when they see you improving the process more and more to make their life easier, it works out well. And so that organization now is about 160 members. A few people joined us this morning. We had our morning huddle and a few people joined. So it's a little bit over 160 today. And then I'm a investor, but also an active partner in a manufacturing business in St. Louis. We manufacture leather parts and stuff like that. And I do a lot of speaking and books and stuff. So that's kind of its own little business, but that business is just me and an assistant.
Right. Wow. Well, you're doing a lot of stuff, and I know your story had a lot of early success and then a little pain and suffering sprinkled in and then some more success.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. But I love your analogy about programming and having structure because our audience, Mike, is service companies, home-based services. We have lawn care and we have carpet cleaners and window cleaners, pressure cleaners. And I notice they try to go really wide with what they offer instead of go deep. And what happens is they can't really be deliver a predictable deliverable at the end, like you were talking about, and it's a mess. And so they can only scale up to their own mental bandwidth or their own available hours, and then that's it, right?
Yeah, I think what we have to realize is that we all are manufacturers at the end of the day. And I don't mean that in a negative connotation, but we all manufacture an end result for our customer. So if you maintain a lawn as a business, or if you clean chimneys, or if you are a programming company, at the end, you're delivering something specific. If you maintain a lawn, maybe it's beautification, or maybe it's a green experience or something. But our customers are buying an end experience. No one buys the fact that you're cleaning the lawn. They want their property to be beautified. Mm-hmm. So you have to know that's the end deliverable. But then, because we're manufacturers, you have to understand your job is to make that same result happen over and over and over again. If I'm a manufacturer and I make scissors, say, for my company, I have to make the same scissor. I can't have a different scissor delivered to the stores every single time, because the customer wouldn't have any consistency. And the more consistent I am, the better I can make my scissors more efficiently. It can be a better quality scissor because I know how to buy the right parts and to sharpen it and develop it the right way. So in your, say, lawn cleaning business, lawn maintenance business, know you're providing beautification. Then use the manufacturing principle of reverse engineering. Once you know what you need to deliver, just like a manufacturer will make a prototype of that scissor, they then will reverse engineer. They'll figure out what are the fewest steps I need to take to get this end result, and what are the exact ingredients, parts that I need to make that happen. So it's efficient. And I think most businesses in most industries, particularly in the service industry, actually don't reverse engineer. They ad hoc engineer. And what that is I say, hey, that's sort of a lawn maintenance business. I think I need a mower and some blowers and, you know, a truck to haul this stuff around. And then I go to a job and I start doing a job and say, oh, I need lawn trimmers. I never knew hedges would be such a pain to maintain. I need to go back and buy some equipment. And then we start doing this stuff. And then, you know, one customer says, hey, can you do shaping for my hedges? I like to make it, you know, make a design or something like that.
A unicorn. They need a unicorn design for sure. That's what it would be.
The unicorn. And then the customer pushes us down a path that we've lost that original idea because we never had it, of lawn beautification. But if we pick the end result, we would say, oh, you know what? I don't do those sculptured hedges. Oh, I don't need these supplies. Oh, I should get a larger mower instead of only a smaller mower. I should get a ride on as opposed to a push, or what, you know, whatever. But if you reverse engineer it, the question always is, how do I get to the end result the fastest and least expensive while maintaining the quality? And that's where you make your money.
Yep. And you're right, man. Small business owners, they have a lot of fear. They make decisions. They say yes to everything because they're chasing the dollars. They don't have a clear vision for their company. I guess there's probably a lot of reasons. And my heart goes out to those people because they're kind of digging their own, not grave, that would be a little much. They're digging their own box. They're boxing themselves in. They can't scale. They're all things to all people and really not doing a great job at anything. I love the quote, there's riches in the niches, right? Like, it's okay to be a specialist. So that's why heart surgeons make many multiples more personal income than a general practitioner doctor, right? They do one thing, freaking awesome. That's it, right?
Yeah, and it's so funny. So I use that exact analogy all the time now to explain about the riches and the niches. And here's what I think is interesting about the general practitioner. I suspect everyone listening to your show right now, Joshua, everyone listening has a general practitioner. And while I don't know who's listening, I know some basic principles. Your general practitioner, the copay is probably $50 or less. Your general practitioner is probably in the vicinity of you that's a convenient drive away. And your general practitioner can diagnose everything from a fever to a cough to a skin rash to the new Zika virus. Now, here's the problem. That means a general practitioner can only attract people in the general vicinity. They're providing a diverse set of offerings. I can check out a skin rash or diagnose you for Zika, but anyone can do that. Therefore, I can only attract people in my general vicinity. I live in the New York area. I don't travel to California to visit a general practitioner. That'd be ridiculous. The second thing, the general practitioner can't dictate a premium. If that general practitioner said, oh, that $50 copay isn't working for me, I'm going to bump it to $5,000 for every visit as a copay, screw you, pal. Like, no way. So I won't travel and I won't pay a premium. But here's the greatest irony. If that general practitioner diagnoses my heart or my cough or whatever I have as a heart defect that's triggering that reaction, he then will say, oh, you got to see the specialist. So the general practitioner has to constantly be studying at the surface level. What's the new problems? Oh, Zika? I got to go back to school and study Zika. But I can't diagnose it or treat it. I only can identify its existence and then refer them to a specialist. The specialist, the heart surgeon you mentioned, think about them. I'm in New York. If I'm having a heart attack, I will go to California or heart problems. I will go to the world's best specialist. If the heart specialist says it's $5,000 a copay, I will borrow from friends and family. I will find that money. The lesson with the surgeon, the specialist, is they attract a very specialized customer, a customer with a special specific need, who will pay a premium and go to extraordinary measures to acquire that service. Now, the great irony with the surgeon is that he always attracts customers with what's called life-threatening challenges. You know, their life's on the line. So the customer is very invested in a successful outcome. The customer wants this to work. The greatest irony, though, is that heart specialist doesn't go to school anymore. A heart specialist does the same thing over and over. She will diagnose and perform a surgery on someone with heart problems. And the reason we want her is because she only does one thing. I don't want to be the first patient to have heart surgery. I want to be the 1,000th patient of that doctor. So they actually study less. They study more focused, but they don't have to go back to school. Yes, new technologies come out and they study that. But the general practitioner, it's a constant onslaught of super viruses and diseases and problems. They constantly have to learn. The specialist attracts the special customer. And so how this translates to our business, whatever it may be, we'll go back to lawn care. There are certain customers out there. It's usually the 80-20 rule. 20% of the customers will pay 80% of the premium. So there's 20% of that neighborhoods or families out there who see their property as so critically, life-threateningly important that they will pay a premium so that when they have guests or they have family visiting or whatever, that it represents them the way they want to be represented. 80% are general practitioners. They say, I just want someone that can mow my lawn. Just get the job done. Better be cheap. So are you attracting, are you trying to cater to the elite customer who is very critical and demanding of a great, perfect result, or are you looking for someone that just needs lawn care? If you're looking for someone who wants the best, they will be vested in the outcome. They're usually the best customers. They will say, okay, what's your suggestions? And they'll live by it to some degree. It's ironically those low-end customers that nickel and dime you who complain the most.
That's right.
Ah, you didn't do it right. I'm not going to pay you. Because all they care about is the dollar, the return per dollar they're getting. So they always measure you on that, and they push you on price. Go for the elite customers.
Oh, man. There's so much good stuff packed in there, Mike. Way to go on that. And I told this story on my podcast before, but you'll think it's hilarious. So I had a friend with a lawn care business in Michigan, and he actually lost an account one time over 50 cents per cut in price. Literally, this is true. Okay, he's a personal friend of mine, and he was so like confounded looking at this lady. Like, wait, she's like, yeah, we're gonna have to let you go. And he's like, well, why? You know, why is everything okay? Well, no, we just found someone cheaper. He was like $28 a cut, and they got a $27.50. But the point is, what you're saying is we have to decommoditize our service offerings and our business. We have to create our own category or niche down or specialize in something so that we're not just another loaf of bread on the rack next to every other $1 loaf of bread. Because when you do that, there's no stickiness to what you do. You're just a commodity, right? I mean, do you see it that way?
You got to pick your community. And you know, it's funny. So many businesses say, but my business, my market is small, medium businesses. I serve anyone, or you know, anyone within a 50-mile vicinity of where I am, I will service. So anyone could use me. But that's horrible. That's not segmenting. There's different types of customers. Just like some customers are extremely loyal to Mercedes or BMW, and others say, I just want the cheapest car that gets me from point A to point B. I'm not saying one or the other is bad, but I will tell you, once you have a community that has a very specific buying requirement, you can cater to that requirement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'll give you a very specific story. I was out at a conference speaking about 2 weeks ago and literally ran into a lawn maintenance guy. And he says, I only do second homes for very wealthy people. Now, he was in the Jackson Hole area, so a big travel. He said, but you have to, this has to be your second home, not your primary home. And I said, well, why is that important? He's like, because my service set changes. He goes, I photograph the property and send it to the people, when the owner. Now, he goes, when it's a second home, a lot of people have their family or guests visit. Some of them like different requirements. Like some of them, when they come, they bring young families. They want to have not play sets, but the games and stuff out, set up outside. So it goes, we'll prepare the lawn a certain way and we'll actually set that stuff up for them. Other times they're going to have a party there. So they want the property prepared in a certain way so that they can host a wedding or some big party there. He goes, so there's actually a lot of pre-planning based upon who's coming out there. And he goes, the regular lawn guy, he just shows up on Thursday and mows the lawn. He goes, I'm actually showing up a month prior to the next guest coming, having a dialogue with the owner, determining what's the best way to stage the property for the next event. And because of this, he charges a massive premium.
Right. Price is irrelevant at that point, right?
Everyone else is irrelevant. And the guys are competing on price can say, but I can do what he does for one third the price. But you can't speak the language. You don't have the understanding of the customer like he does. So you will never compete on price. They'll always compete on the ability to cater to the customer specific needs.
One of the problems that I see, though, Mike, with these guys actually, because we're talking, we're passionate, that what we're talking about is truth. I mean, it's like math. I mean, this works. If you niche down and specialize, you make more money. It's less about price, more about value. All that stuff is just established truth in my book. But the problem is this is going to require the people listening to this podcast to start saying no to stuff.
And oh, yeah.
It's really hard. There's this new hot book out, Essentialism. I'm sure you've heard of it.
I have.
The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. Love the subtitle. Super wicked clever. But we're not good at saying no to stuff, especially when we're living in fear and money. And then we can pivot into profit first here, because the financial pressure, the mismanagement, the burden, it causes us to make bad decisions and to say yes to everybody and everything, regardless if it's a good fit for where we want to take our business, right?
Yeah. And so I realized that feeling, because I've lived it myself too. My businesses only grew once I became niche specialized, but there's a fear of loss. So I have a mix of customers. And by the way, when you're just starting up, to commit to a niche is a little bit risky because you have no experience. I mean, if I was just opening my business today and say, I'm only going to do second homeowner properties, and you have no experience, it's a little risky. So you do have to get your feet under you. I don't deny that. But at a certain point, you start becoming the general practitioner and you have to make that decision. Do I want to be the heart specialist or the general practitioner? Now, here's the key. The term, and I think you even said it, Josh, is it's niche specialization. This is not niche exclusivity. And I think that's where people get confused. People think about a niche and they say, well, that means I have to say no to all this potential business. If any of my existing clients aren't in the niche, I got to fire them. And what if this niche collapses? What if the economy tanks and there's no more second homeowners? I'm out of business. Niche specialization just means you play favoritism to it until you have real strong traction. So here's the process. Identify the niche you want to cater to, the second homeowners or whatever, and then first focus and concentrate your marketing there. Don't market to the others. Just market to this community. You'll still attract business through word of mouth and so forth. And maybe another customer comes and they don't have that second home. They don't fit your profile, but you evaluate the opportunity and it's good money. It's convenient for you. It's a no-brainer. Well, then take the work. Like, we're not saying decline it, but just focus your marketing. Once your marketing's focused and you start getting traction, then in that community, the word of mouth will break. The guy at the second home tells the other guy, who's your lawn guy? Your lawn, your property's beautiful. Oh, it's so-and-so. He specializes in our type of setup. Great. I want to hire him too. So once you start marketing there, the word of mouth, meaning the customer will start carrying the marketing for you. It's only at that point, once you start getting momentum, then you start making strategic decisions. Is it more financially viable to go for that next guy at the second home and turn down the guy that that is not in this category anymore?
It's so good what you're talking about. Because look, there's two things that drive me nuts. One thing is little businesses that just start out, they go online, they go on the message boards, the forums. Do we call them message boards anymore? Anyway, you go to Facebook groups, right? And they're like, hey, I just got this job. And then they'll post a picture and they underbid it because they don't know anything yet.
Oh,
and then everybody attacks them like they're some sort of, you know, worthless scum because they're trying to better their life or start a business.
Right.
But look, zero, you know, making $11 instead of $0 is better than $0. Like, I coach people to just start, just to do it. Because the other flip side of the people that don't want a niche are people that overanalyze up front so much that they can create no momentum at all in their business. They're so obsessed with getting premium dollars day one that they can't build a foundation for their company. And I always tell people, you know, the calibration comes on the back end. And what I mean by calibration is when you have a book of business and you got some traction, sure, you know, take a look at the 15% of loser jobs and start trimming them out and start calibrating and tweaking and getting things tightened up. But if you don't just get out there and kick butt and have momentum and be imperfect and have imperfect action, you're never going to get anywhere.
That's right. I mean, think about the surgeon. Like that surgeon, his first operation wasn't on a U.S. president, you know, to save that president's life. Right, his first operation was probably on a pig heart of, you know, a cadavered pig heart, and then human cadavers. Like we need to gain the experience and get it under our belt first. And so when starting a business, you got to work in that community. You got to do whatever it takes to get traction and experience. That's actually the most important thing you gain. To the point where literally, I will tell a brand new business, if you have no clients, offer your services for free to one client. Make sure it's a good client. And here's the trade-off. You're going to gain experience, and you're going to tell them, you're my first client, so I'm going to gain experience on you. You just ask for two things in return for that client getting free services. First is you ask that client to give you critical feedback so you can improve, and you schedule a time to meet with them. You know, once a month, I want to come back and hear from you. What can I do better? The second thing is you have to promise to act as a reference. And this is the big one. Because most clients, when they consider your services, will say, who do you also do work for right now? And if you do work for free for that first client, they can become a reference point for you. It sounds like risky, like it costs you money to serve a client. Now you're not making money, but you're gaining such good marketing momentum and experiential exposure that it's worth it in many cases to bring on that first client for free.
I know that many, many of you have a vision for what your business should be like, and maybe today it's not exactly there. Or maybe you have a young business and you don't know where to start. Or maybe your business is seasoned, but you're stuck. Look, I'm not Yoda or anything like that, but I have been there and I've done it, and I have a lot of things I can bring to the table. And in my Automate Grow Sell Bootcamp, there are ridiculous resources, accountability, mastermind group, all kinds of things included that can help you get to where you want to go. If you have an interest in speaking to me directly about your business specifically, now is your chance, but you got to take action. There's limited spots. I don't accept every single appointment. I do vet them a little bit just to make sure you're a good fit. But there is the opportunity for me to spend 45 minutes with you specifically talking about the stuff you're going through and adding value to you. It's not a sales pitch at all. It's 100% focused on serving you. It's a great opportunity. I love what I do. I love working with people. So here's the deal. If you want to set up your free call with me, where I'll give you a 6-page PDF business snapshot report on your business. I'll ask you a lot of questions. I'll dig deep into your pain points and try to serve you. If you want that, you need to go to automategrowsell.com/45. Now, that's just the numerals 4 and 5. automategrowsell.com/45. Do it now while there's still availability. It will be for a short time. We're trying to bring a few new people into the boot camp. After that, that will be it. You need to go to automategrowsell.com/45. Yeah, experience. Look, you are a former columnist. I don't know if you still do that for MSNBC stuff, the Wall Street Journal, keynote. You have all these books. You're a prolific author. You didn't just start there, right? I mean, you had to go get dirt, get your hands dirty, start a business, figure it out, get mentored. I don't know all the details of your story, but
everyone starts like that. So my first business, I was in computer systems and stuff, and my first client, I had no clue what I was doing, but the client was willing to let me gain experience. But even speaking, so I've been very blessed. You know, it's my 8th or 9th year now of speaking. Yet now I'm doing some main stage stuff with really famous names. I mean, with people I've always admired from afar, and now I'm actually meeting these people. But 8 years prior, when I was getting started, literally, I'll never forget this, Josh. One of my early speaking engagements, I spoke at US Irvine. I'm US Irvine. I'm sorry, UC Irvine. So UCI, University of California, Irvine. I get invited to speak at a fraternity. A business fraternity is having a speaking engagement. They're bringing three other fraternities. 100 people are going to show. I'm going to speak. And I get there and I walk into the room and there's one kid sitting there. And that's a half hour early. I said, wow, you guys, no one's here yet. And he's like, I don't know if anyone's going to show. There's a big Blockbuster party going on. And literally when I spoke, no one showed. The only guy there was that kid sitting there, and he wasn't even looking at me. He was just texting away on his Blackboard. And inside, that's, man, awesome. I was crying. I was crying. Like, this is so embarrassing. But I still delivered the speech. I said, I'm going to give this kid that's not even paying attention the world's best speech I can do.
Good for you. I mean, that's incredible. A large percentage of people would not give the speech. I was going to ask you, did you give the speech? Like,
oh, yeah.
I gave the speech. That's epic.
And I'm from the New York area. I had to fly out there on my own dime. All this stuff. Like, this was important for me. And I was like, well, I got to cut my teeth. Nothing. Nothing. Oh. I was kicked in the nuts so hard. I went back to the hotel room and literally cried. Just said, oh, my God, I'm an idiot.
Well, that's an expensive plane ticket, not to mention the blow to the ego, where you're getting hyped up the whole flight. You're going over your notes. You're dialing it in. You're, oh, this joke's going to kill, you know, whatever you do preparing for your speech. And nobody's there. That's awesome. I love that happened to you. I mean, it's easy for me to say. It didn't happen to me. But
I appreciate this.
It's a great story. And the people that listen to this show, they work hard, man, and they have these hopes and dreams, and they quickly get dashed by reality when, you know, they think they can launch a business on 10 grand, and then their first employee doesn't show up, and then they don't understand capital expenses, they don't understand anything, and then their mower breaks or their pressure clean. It's a road littered with pain and suffering. But you got to just look, it's with anything else. You got to persevere. You have to endure. You have to have grit. You have to walk through the fire. That's what I call it. Walk through the fire. Lean into the pain. Oh, now I'm all excited. So
and I agree to all that. And there's was one caveat. If you continue to walk through the fire on purpose, that's when you're hurting yourself. And that's what people do. You know, listen, I get kicked in the nuts proverbially and physically maybe once in a while, but proverbially by my wife. Proverbially, you know, every so often I get my ass handed to me. I think when the cockiness kicks in, and hopefully that's very rare nowadays, but still, I'm like, okay, I'm on my game now. And that's when I get the kick to the nuts. But I realize that that's a great thing to keep me in check and keep me driving forward. But if I'm constantly walking a gauntlet where it's you're getting kicked in the nuts every single day, that's also an indicator that that's not working. We need to make an improvement. So once in a while, being humbled, we need that. Being humbled every single day means there's something wrong. Yeah. And the answer goes, or how you fix that goes back to that manufacturing principle. When we have too many variables, it's inevitable there's a slip up. I had a lawn guy who maintained my lawn. I even wrote about him in my book, in Profit First. He maintained my lawn, and one day he says, hey, you know, I noticed there's leaves in your gutter. I can clean out your gutters. And I swear to you, he went on my roof with a hand blower for the yard, and he's blowing out my gutters. And when he's up there, he comes back down, and he goes, hey, I also noticed that your roofing is coming a little bit loose. He goes, I think I can fix that. Do you want me to fix it? By the time he was done, I assume the repair was inadequate. I had him do it, and he had what was called a captive customer, which is a very dangerous. It's kind of like a mermaid. It seems really attractive until it drowns you. He's like, oh, I have a captive customer. This guy Mike will keep spending money with me, but he was so inefficient. At the end of the day, he worked at my house the entire day. He actually had to go to the Home Depot three or four times to get parts. He even got floodlights to keep working through the night. And at the end of the day, the roofing material and the leaves they took off of my roof were all on the ground. He had to clean my lawn again for free. So he actually lost money on me playing into this idea of a captive customer. We've got to be niche focused. Don't try to expand for your customers. Actually become more narrowly focused.
That's a great story, and my heart goes out to that guy because, you know, he's probably good dad. You know, coaches the t-ball team. He's doing what the best he can. Maybe. It starts with education. He doesn't know. He doesn't know what he doesn't know. That's why, if you're hearing this podcast, you are blessed. You are lucky. Count your blessings. Don't just consume content all day. Put it into practice. Do something with it. Good grief. Anyway, so tell us. you know, because I know you're going to have to run because you have to, you know, go meet the president-elect and do all this other stuff.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah.
But tell us about Profit First, because people requested that I beg you to come on my show. They want to know about that book. They're excited about Profit First, the concept. Can you break it down for the rest of the people that aren't familiar?
Absolutely. So, you know, I've been very fortunate to have owned many businesses. And when you read a CV, my CV, which stands for Curriculum Vitae, I thought, it's always the bullet point. So you had a business, sold it, had another business, sold it, and blah, blah, blah. But under, I think a CV really stands for the words covers vomit, because under under those little accolades, those bullet points, which represents one page, there is a heaping pile of just puke and struggle. And part of mine was, yeah, I grew these businesses, but I was never profitable. I had to refinance my house 3 times. I remember having to pay payroll. I couldn't afford it. And sitting at home shaking, pure stress, saying, who can I borrow money from now to cover payroll this month? It was horrible. So I always thought profit was an event, something that would happen in the future. If that one big customer, I finally landed them, or I got that one big contract. And I almost went bankrupt. I should have actually declared it. My ego was too big to even do that. But I was on the verge of bankruptcy. I lost every dollar I'd earned in selling my businesses, all the stuff. And my wife and I, we lost our house. We lost our everything, and has started anew. And that woke me up. It took time, but it woke me up to the fact that profit is not an event. Profit is a habit. It's something that needs to be baked into every transaction, every moment, every transaction you have in your business. There's got to be a piece of profit, and these small pieces add up. And here's the real simple principle to do it. Every time you take a deposit into your business, I don't care if it's $1, $100, $1,000, or $10,000, whatever the deposit is, you take a percentage of that, a predetermined percentage, and you allocate it toward profit. So if $1,000 comes in, we're taking 10%, we literally take $100 and you deposit it into a separate hidden away account. We're going to call it a profit account. Then you run your business as you normally do off of $900. And what happens is there's this theorem called Parkinson's law. It's a behavioral theorem, but basically it states that we adjust our consumption based upon the supply in front of us. Meaning, if I serve a plate of food for Thanksgiving that just passed, a huge plate of food, I will eat more. If I serve a dessert size tray or plate of food, I will eat less because there's less food in front of me. Same thing is true for food, but it's true for money too. If there is more money available, we log into our bank account, we see how much money sitting there, we will subconsciously consume it. Oh, I need to grow my business. I can buy that equipment I needed. I got to pay payroll. But if there's less money there, then we kick into the frugality and innovation. We say, well, I don't have as much money as I thought I did. I guess I won't buy that equipment yet. I'll delay it. Oh, maybe I'll buy used. Oh, you know, instead of using, you know, this kind of labor, I'll use that kind of labor. But we start finding a way to make it work with what we have. So that's the core lesson of Profit First. Intentionally take your profit out immediately when you get a deposit, transfer that money away, hidden away from you, and run your business off the remainder. It's the pay yourself first principle applied to business, and it will bring profitability to your business instantly.
It's amazing. And some of the most powerful ideas in the world are so simple. It's like when you hear you talk about this, it's like, oh my word, why do we not do this already? How are there so many millions of people not doing this? You're basically taking a P&L statement where you have your top line revenue, and then you have expenses in the middle, and then you get, if there's a number left at the bottom, then congratulations for you, right? Well, you're moving that number at the bottom to right under the top, and then you're running your business on the expenses that are left, which totally makes sense. And kind of like Dave Ramsey's pay yourself first principle, I think, or maybe that's Robert Kiyosaki. I don't know.
Yeah.
Very, very cool stuff. So the book talks about that, breaks it down. How important is it to make sure you can't see the money, see the little basket of goodies you got for yourself? Do you hide it on your online banking or something so you can't
massively
see?
Massively important. So in the book, I explained it. There's 4 core principles. That pay yourself first is one of them. The envelope system. This is an age-old system called the envelope system. That's part of it. And remove temptation is one. And removing temptation is a behavioral – there's a behavioral study about willpower. The only way to resist temptation, or one way to resist temptation, is willpower. Mine's chocolate chip cookies. You know, if you put chocolate chip cookies on the table, I will say no the first time. And then I'll look at it again and say, no, I really shouldn't, right? And basically willpower starts – fatiguing like a muscle when you're working out, only a certain point in time before you can't do anymore. So I'll say, I shouldn't. Well, one bite won't hurt, and then gobble, 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 the whole thing is gone. So with money, if we keep that profit visible, we just, take the money out and put it into a separate checking account or something, but we can see it, we'll say, I can't pay my bills. I shouldn't use profit. I'll just borrow from my profit account. I'll just borrow. And we defeat the system. When you take your profit and you hide it away so you can't see it, meaning you transfer it to another bank and there's no online banking, no nothing, you just deposit it out of sight, out of mind, then when you can't pay bills this time, you say, I don't know if I'm going to pay bills, and that's your business telling you you're running your business improperly. Find a better way to run your business, and you have to make do with what you have. Then the miracle moment happens that, and I suggest quarterly, once every 90 days, is then you actually take that profit account and you distribute it. And now the rule is when you distribute the profit, it is only for your purposes as the owner. Celebrate with it. Go, if it's a few $100, go out for a killer dinner with the spouse. If it's a few $1,000, maybe you're heading on a vacation or something. But celebrate with it. Because if you take that money and plow it back into your business, and that's the word we like to use, plow back. I hate that word. Reinvest, I hate it. It means, that money I said's profit really isn't profit, it's an expense. The rule is when the profit's taken away, its only purpose is to reward you as an owner of the business, and your job is to think smarter, to think more innovatively. How do you make your business work with what's left over? And you'll find it.
That's incredible. That's incredible, Mike. I mean, really serious value that you're dropping here. All for free from the sky. Guys, you got to buy the book Profit First. And he has a lot of other books, everybody. He has The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur, super, super popular book. All of his books ridiculously reviewed on Amazon, by the way. And that just says it all. I mean, how hard is it to even get someone to do a review? You have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them because you have a good way with words and breaking down what could seem like a complex topic into a very, very simple, easy to execute thing. And there's really no excuse for us to not be in control. Why did we start a business? To be a slave to it and to just spin our wheels? And yeah, and you ever heard the phrase vanity metric, right? Everybody's obsessed with revenue. Well, yeah, I built a 10-figure business. I have I'm going to the club this weekend with my seven. But really, at the end of the day, profit is the only number that matters.
That was me. I was that D-bag, the revenue guy. And I'm so embarrassed about it, Josh, but I think it's important to share because I really believed it. Like, yeah, I wanted to say, my business is now 10 million. I remember when I hit the first million, like I just felt this little chest kind of stick out and pound my chest a little bit. And I'm like, I'm now a $1 million business. And then when the guy next to me is like, I have a $5 million business. I'm like, curse him. I must be a $5 million business. And it was never enough. But the irony was that top line is a stress metric. The more revenue a business generates, the more stress there is on the business. Because I got to support that with infrastructure. So running, I've had a 1, a 5, the biggest business I ever had was 7 million. Every time the revenue increased, there was more infrastructure, more stress. There was more panic to keep the money flowing. But profitability, that, if revenue is vanity, profit is sanity. The profit, that's the health of your business. Like, I would way rather have a $200,000 business that throws to me $150,000 a year than a $1 million business that throws me $150,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Because it's less stress, more health. The question, of course, is how do you do it? So I'm constantly now looking at profit first. How do I drive my profitability? And by the way, whenever someone says, tell me how big your business is, I will respond now, not in a dicky way, but I'll say, you know what, let's not talk about how big, let's talk about how healthy our businesses are. So I love to share my metrics on my business's health if you're willing to do the same. And it changes the paradigm. It's no longer this chest pounding, like how big is your business? Mm-hmm. How big is it? The classic question. It's now about what's driving profitability? How smartly are you running your business?
Right. And what is it demanding of you? And how's your marriage? And do your kids know their father? I mean, I joke around a lot, but at the end of the day, I'm a family guy, right? Yeah. My relationship with my wife, and my children is everything. And people miss it. And so many small businesses, like, wreak havoc on relationships, right? Because we have to chase the dream and we have to work 100 hours. And then when your wife is like, you don't love us, you're like, how dare you not respect? Don't you see the sacrifice I'm – but, you know, it's this age-old story. And at the end of the day, if we're honest with ourselves, it's heavily ego-driven. It's a bunch of bull crap. We totally could take back control, simplify things, learn to say no to things, learn to put profit first. I mean, this isn't rocket science, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not. It's not. And all those variables that you shared, that is what's important. It's there's an old story about the Mexican fisherman. Have you heard this one? And the American?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good, though. Tell it. It's great.
All right. So the quick summary of this is there's this wealthy American who is on vacation from the business he owns. You know, it does $10 or $20 million in revenue. Remember, that's vanity. And he's taking a quick three-day vacation. That's all he can afford as time away from his business in Mexico. He sees a fisherman out there, and this fisherman's coming back in with his catch of the day, and he has a conversation. The fisherman explains that every day he wakes up at, he sleeps in to maybe 8 in the morning and then takes his children to school. His wife and them, him have a lunch together every day and a siesta in the evenings, or in the afternoons he goes fishing, and then in the evenings he plays guitar with his friends. And the American looks at him and says, but don't you know? That fish you caught, the size of it, he's like, if you just stayed out there instead of fishing for an hour for your food for the dinner that night, why don't you fish for like 8 hours and you bring back a load of this stuff and you can start selling your fish. And, you know, this will perpetuate on, like the selling fish then will allow you to buy more boats and more hire people. And then you can have your own canning factory and you can have a massive business. And the Mexican looks at him. He says, well, what will happen? And the American's like, well, you'll have a business like I do, like $20 or $30 million. And he goes, okay, but what happens once I have that? He goes, well, if you work real hard for another 40 years, at the end, you'll actually be able to take a long vacation. And he goes, then you got to live a comfortable lifestyle. He goes, you'll get able to sleep until like 8 or 9 in the morning, take your children to school. And he recounts the full thing. Have lunch with your wife and friend, And the Mexican, just looks at him stupefied. The opportunity to live our lifestyle is in front of us right now, the lifestyle we desire. And I think – actually, I'm convinced now that is the starting point. Define the lifestyle that we are committed to based upon happiness. Our businesses are designed then to supplement that, not to get us there, but to supplement it. So if we start living the lifestyle we desire today, we have already arrived. Now the business kind of molds in around that and just allows it to sustain longer and longer. That's a successful business, in my opinion.
I will let that be the final word, because that was awesome. Awesome stuff. Very inspirational. Mike, you've been awesome. You told us about some of the struggles you've had and the successes you've had. You've talked about your book and given a lot of free value here today. How can people connect with you in regards to Profit First or anything else that you have? Your last name is Impossible. So
Impossible.
How do
impossible.
We deal with that when they're trying to track
you? Yeah, so I got a couple of shortcuts. So everything is on my website, which is MikeMikalowicz.com. I get it. No one can spell it. It is literally the longest Polish name on the planet. And there's two ways to get to me, like $3. And I used to write for the Wall Street Journal. I share all the articles I wrote. If you go to Google and just type in Mike and then Mick, M-I-K-E, and then the new word M-I-C, just look at the drop down and the longest, most Polish name. That's me. Pick that. The other one, though, my nickname in high school was Mike Motorbike. So you can go to MikeMotorbike.com, and that will get you to the same spot.
Ah, very clever. I like it. Very good stuff. Mike, thank you so much for being generous with your time. I know we're going to have a lot of people coming your way and hopefully connecting with the Profit First team that you have so they can get fully set up with that. Thank you so much.
Josh, thank you.
Hey, thanks for hanging out, friends. And from all of us here at the Quick Talk Podcast team, we hope you loved today's show. We hope that you were inspired to become a doer and not just a listener. Apply what you've heard today in your own business and watch things change for the better. Lastly, remember that all the money in the world can't save your soul. Seek first the kingdom of God, my friends. We'll see you next time.
For more information about the Quick Talk Podcast or Joshua's other businesses, visit our website, quicktalkpodcast.com. Have a blessed day.